Hey, everybody. I'm Cliff Gooding. I'm a grateful alcoholic. I'm sober since August the 15th of 2001, and for that short amount of time, I'm as grateful as I know how to be. And it's good to be back in Atlanta and Atlanta area. It's hard to be in Atlanta. I'm like a head on that microphone. I'm just like a head floating. I could be. I definitely look shorter on this one. Yeah, I usually say, does that make me look taller? But I'm going, no, I just know. It does not. No, I'm good. I'm good. I look like something out of a Halloween show, just floating head. So it's good to be and see everybody here tonight. A bunch of my friends, my buddy Tom R. on there. I see him and Deb, of course, from New York. My buddy Randy, who I've known for a long, long time, Ramona. A bunch of other people. I'm sure I've missed some folks that are on there. And my buddy Bill and his beautiful wife Betsy here tonight, and it's good to have you all here. My buddy Tom and all my new friends that I've met here this group tonight. So it's really good to be here. I knew this was going to be a really good weekend when I left my house this morning. My wife took me to the airport, and when we left this morning, my neighbor was out in his front yard. And he waved goodbye to me, and he used all five fingers. So I knew it was going to be a good weekend, right? Did all of them. So I knew this weekend was off to a good start, and a little bit of delays out of Oklahoma City, getting a plane from here to there and then back. But we got it all done and gathered up in one spot. So I'm grateful. Jerry, thank you for asking me. I'm in town this weekend for the Howe anniversary, and Jerry snagged me up and said, would you come do this? And I'm grateful to do this and grateful to be here tonight and do this. So I heard a speaker one time, and he started talking, and he said, everybody's here knows how to get drunk. And so he started talking about when he got sober. He spent a whole hour just talking about his life in sobriety. That's probably not going to happen tonight, but I thought that was an amazing talk. So you're probably not going to get that one tonight, but I'm a kid growing up that, far back as I can remember, I've had this piece of me. When I come to AA, I heard somebody say in a meeting early on, I'm just restless, irritable, discontent. And when they said that, it was like everything jailed for me. It was like, my God, this guy's a genius. I mean, I didn't know he was cheating and reading out of the book, but I thought, that's it. He put words at my 41 years of age, words that I could understand of how I had felt, or it seemed that I have felt as far back as I could remember, although I could not have articulated that. What it felt like, not because I have some kind of great recall from when I was in kindergarten, but when I look back on my life at that period of time in my life, it's like I remember going to kindergarten class. My mama had me there early. I remember going in that little red schoolhouse. She had me spit, shine, and ready, Brian. I mean, I was good to go. And I remember walking in there and looking at all those little kids whose heads immediately popped up when I walked in the door. And the conscious feeling I have about that is, my God, these kids know the answers to all the questions, and I don't know what book they're reading out of. And, you know, by the time I'm in grade school, looking around, I begin to have these thoughts that I don't know where they come from. I mean, I don't know where some of this stuff comes from. I mean, walking in and being in class thinking, you know, if my mom and dad lived in a better neighborhood, I'd be okay. If these people over here, if I was friends with them, I'd be all right. If I had those clothes, and you know, when I get to high school, if I was taller, if I was more athletic, if I drove a better car, if I dated this girl, when I got out in the workforce, if I had a better job, if I lived in the right neighborhood, if I had his wife, if I had his girlfriend, if I could get them both at the same time, perhaps even then my life would be greatly improved. And I don't know where that comes from, this idea, if I can somehow get the picture right out here, that somehow I'll be happy. I don't know where that comes from. This idea that, you know, I'm unhappy, I'm dissatisfied, I'm unsatisfied, particularly with my current situation. Seems to me my whole life I've lived it like, if I can get to here, I'll be all right. I remember being a kid, you know, when I was 10, 11, 12, I thought, when I get to be 13, I'll be okay. When I'm 13, I want to be 16. When I'm 16, I want to be 18. When I'm 18, I want to be 21. When I'm 63 now, I want to be 21. It's that kind of deal, you know. So no matter where I'm at, I'm not happy. It's like, if I get to here, I'll be all right. And I don't know where that comes from. Our friend Larsine, who great member of the Alamon Family Group out in California says, you know, information floats through the universe, it lands on my head, and I begin to take action like it's the truth. And it's just that idea that if I can get to some point, it's like if I can hit some benchmark, I'll be all right. If I just acquire enough out here, and I don't even know what it is that I need to acquire. That's the craziest thing. I mean, I don't even know what it is that I'm trying to run to. But it seems if I can just get to this spot, I'll be okay. And I couldn't put words to that. I mean, I couldn't articulate that. You know, but what happens to a guy like me is I become increasingly insecure because I don't feel like I'm enough. I don't feel like I have to get over the hump. And I don't even know what it is, but I don't have it. I know that for sure. And I'm just, you know, the 12 of 12 talks about my biggest problem is defective human relationships because I don't know how to have them. I don't really have friends or girlfriends. I have hostages. I mean, I just take you as a prisoner. And because I don't know how to do anything. And if you're somebody that I'm dating and you make a comment about somebody else, I mean, my whole world shatters. It's like I'm not enough again. And then I make you pay for that. And it's just this whirly-turbly kind of mess that seems like my life is in. And when I was 11 years old, it's important for you to know I had 11 years of sobriety at one time. When I was 11 years old, my brother... I grew up in southeast Oklahoma under a big old weeping willow tree. He opened a tall boy can of Country Club malt liquor. Anybody here ever drink Country Club malt liquor besides Randy and me? You did, sir? I know Randy did. Well, for the rest of y'all, that's God working in your life. That's all I'm going to tell you about that. But he opened up this big tall boy can of Country Club malt liquor, and he took a drink, and he handed it to me. And I don't know how long it took us to finish that tall boy beer underneath that weeping willow tree. But however long it took, when it was over, I can tell you this, the magic of alcohol happened for me. And I tell you, it's the magic of alcohol because that's the way the book describes it, in that the illusion that it created me, the effect it produced in me was so profound on that day. Our book describes it as, you know, there'll come a point when I'll be willing to chase it to the gates of insanity or death, not up to, into. And that's the kind of effect it had on me. I'm not a kid that drank that day and thought, blacked out, puked, and it was the end of my social drinking. That's just not my experience, but I knew I needed to do this as often as I could. Because, you know, that sensation of everything I described up to taking that beer with my brother vanished. All that, what I know today, what our book describes as restless, irritable, discontentedness. As Bill described the bedevilments, I have been bedeviled my entire life. Those things that Bill describes and we agnostics, that pervade my life. But when I drank, it just disappeared. And by the time I get to high school, I'm a daily drinker. And a buddy of mine, my senior year, we had a zero-hour class. It met at like 7, 7:30. I can't remember when. Now, the legal drinking age in Oklahoma at that particular time when I was growing up, it was 18 for gals and 21 for guys. So you always need an older woman with you wherever you were. And so but a buddy of mine, we found that there was a little store in town that at 6 in the morning, the legal drinking age was old enough to get your money on the counter. And he and I would pool our money every day. We'd whatever change we could scrape up every day. And we would go in and buy an 8-pack of Pony Millers. You guys remember 8-packs of Pony Millers? Yeah. You're the same people that remember Sonic Ice and Boone's Farm. I know you are. So we would split an 8-pack of Pony Miller. We'd split them right down the middle. I'd have 6 and he'd have 2. And I'd drink those. And I would get a cool buzz on, and I could go to school and I could operate around those people, seemingly like they were. And I'm a blackout drinker. By the time I get to college, I'm a blackout drinker. I have a photographic memory. If I read something, I retain it. I knew at an early age that there was something different about me, that I was different from other kids because I could read and retain. And it wasn't something I talked about, I didn't tell them about, but I could go to class and read the books and come back and test and get A's. And that would serve me well. because what I am is I was a rule follower. Growing up, I was a rule follower. And I never gave my parents any trouble. I was not a kid that got in trouble. That would come later, much later. But I wasn't a kid that got in trouble. I was following the rules. I'm a guy because I figured out if I don't get in trouble, I get to do what I want to do. But I have a photographic memory, which served me well because I would go out drinking and I could be able to go take a test in college the next day and do well on it because I could just regurgitate the information back. Now, I got to tell you, the toner's getting a little low these days, but I'm a lawyer by trade. And so I was a blackout drinker in college, and I really began to notice differences in my drinking around other people when I got out in the workforce. I mean, I knew that it seemed to me the people around me in college, they all drank like me. I think that's the biggest lie I tell myself my perception is that everybody drinks like me. And to some extent, that was true. There was a lot of people that I drank with, friends of mine growing up, I drank with. And they looked a lot like me. We would come home for the holidays and, well, we would just get it on. But then the strangest thing happened to some of those people. They would meet him, they would meet her, and they just quit. They get these great jobs, they just stop. And when they stopped drinking, their lives got better. They got promotions at work. They started having kids. They got bought houses, bought bigger houses, got those things called 401ks, those kind of things, you know. And their lives objectively got better. They got better. So while they looked like me, what I discovered is they were not like me. And because they looked like me, I had this illusion or delusion that I could quit anytime I wanted to. I just didn't want to. And but when I got out in the workforce, I remember the very first time that first week I was at work at a big law firm in downtown Oklahoma City after I graduated law school, I had gone, one of the partners had come to me on like a Wednesday or Thursday and said, listen, after work, we're going to go get some cocktails. Would you like to do that? Now, I'm from the country. I'm a country kid. So cocktails, I mean, that just sounds sophisticated. I mean, I don't know about you, but that sounds like something I need to be part of, right? Because I would need to be cool like that. And I thought, yes, I definitely want to do that. But when somebody asked me questions like that, I got questions. And so the day he asked me, would you like to go with us? I said, well, where are we going? Because it's important information. I need to know, where are we going? And I said, and who's going? And what time are we going? Those are all pertinent data that a guy like me needs to know. And I think he said, well, there's going to be you and me and a couple others, be four of us. And we're going to go at 5:30, and we're going to go to Pinstripes, which is a bar in one of the big hotels in downtown Oklahoma City. And I said, I'll get the table. Because I don't know how you drink, but the reason information like that's important to me, because if Jerry said to me, Cliff, tomorrow night, we're going to go out drinking, we're going to go at 9, I'd say, I'm in. But I don't know how you drink, but I don't wait to 9 to start drinking. I've got to start drinking about 6 to get ready to go drinking at 9. I mean, I don't wait. And so what I did was I went to Pinstripes and I got the table at 4:30. And so when they show up at 5:30, I'm already well into it. And they sit down and the cocktail waitress comes around and they order drinks. And you know how it is, about 10 minutes later, she comes back. And she looked at the first person. Now, this fella had like 3/4 of his drink gone. So he got a quarter of a drink on the table. She looks at him and said, would you like another? And he says this, no. My wife's cooking dinner and I've got to get home. And so with a quarter of a drink on the table, he pays his tab and gets up and presumably goes home to his wife. And he may not have another drink tonight, next week, next month, next year. May never drink again. Looks at the second person. This lady has about a half a drink left. She said, would you like another? She says, no. My daughter has a soccer game. Starts in about 30 minutes. I got to go with a half a drink on the table. Pays her bill, gets up, goes to her daughter's soccer game, gets there early. Finds her daughter, gives her a hug, tells her she loves her. Goes, sits in the stands with the other parents. Now, this is really important. Does not get thrown out of the soccer game. Really, very important. Afterwards, she goes out with the other parents, has pizza. She may or might not have another drink tonight, tomorrow, next week, next month. May never drink again. Then there's this third person. So this is the person I'm sure you've all encountered. Now, this person has like 3/4 of her drink still on the table. Or maybe it's the worst case scenario, you know, where the ice is melting and the booze is overflowing. Now, I know in this crowd, that's alcohol abuse. I get that. And the waitress looks at her and says, "Would you like another?" And she says the strangest thing of all. She says, "No, I don't care for anymore. I'm beginning to feel it." And I think, okay, now we start ordering tequila shots, right? I mean, so, 'cause if you're feeling it, there's a window. I mean, I don't know how you drink, but when I start to feel it, there's a window, because I'm about to be rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence here. I mean, just any moment, I'm about to go. And so you got to get ready to go. And what I know today is this, that when that lady says, "I don't care for me, I'm beginning to feel it," what she's saying is that the effect of alcohol produces in her, it's significantly different than the effect it produces in me. Because she drinks some and something happens in her, she begins to feel impaired. And she doesn't want anymore. She doesn't like the way that makes her feel. And she says, "I don't want anymore." It's like a bell goes off in her head. "I don't want anymore." But see, that's not the effect alcohol produces in me. When I start drinking, I don't begin to feel impaired. I begin to feel empowered. We're going to get up ready to do some Jekyll and Hyde kind of stuff. You know what I mean? I mean, we're about to go on an expedition or a personal adventure just any moment now. Mm-hmm. And what I discovered about that is there's some points about my drinking is there's only 3 conditions of which I stop: pass out, run out, blackout. But I don't know that. I have no idea about that. And there's also something else I begin to discover about my drinking is that there's always a crash site. I don't know who it's going to be, when it's going to be, or where it's going to be, or who's going to be involved. But there's always a crash site involved in my life. And I didn't know about that. I didn't know about these 3 pieces of alcoholism. How could I? I didn't know anything about that. This, what I described early on when I began this soliloquy tonight, that I have this condition, this malady that keeps me just totally restless, irritable, discontent, a spiritual malady inside of me, this driving force inside of me that keeps me looking outward to figure out if I could get this fixed out here, I'll be okay. It's the peace inside of me that drives that selfishness, self-centeredness. It's the peace inside of me, if I can get this, I'll be happy. It's the peace inside of me, if you'll just do what I want you to do, I'll be happy. And I don't know anything about that. I don't know anything about the physical feature of alcoholism. I don't have any idea that when I start drinking, something different happens in me than 90% of the population. That when I take a drink and ingest it to this body, I have this allergic reaction, as the book describes, as Dr. Silkworth describes, that it sets up in me this phenomenon of craving, this allergic reaction. Now, I know people with allergies, and I'm sure everybody here knows people with some form of allergy. I mean, there are people that are lactose intolerant. They drink some milk, bad things happen to them. People who are allergic to bee stings, strawberries. I mean, we got shellfish, peanuts. My God, the peanut people are just an entity all of their own, aren't they? I mean, they're just by the... Well, since you guys brought it up, we'll talk about them. So the peanut people, peanut allergy, somebody with a peanut allergy eats one peanut and makes one emergency room visit. Let that sink in. One emergency room visit. And you know what they do? They quit forever. I mean, they don't have to go to Peanut Anonymous. They don't have to have a peanut sponsor. They don't even have to read the Peanut Anonymous book. They don't have to do any of that stuff. They go have a bad experience. They go to one emergency room visit. They quit forever. As a matter of fact, if they go to a restaurant, when they walk in the restaurant, they say things like this: "Has a peanut been on this city block?" I mean, it's not enough. Has it been in the restaurant? Has one been on the city block? Because they're serious about this. Now, I'm going to tell you something about me and my relationship with alcohol. Not just the effect it produces, but my relationship with alcohol. See, what happens to me is that I'll give away cars, houses, jobs, careers, wives, children, integrity, dependability, honesty. Never connect the dots. It's the booze. Never connect the dots that all those things are driven by the booze, that once I ingest it, I'm off and running and all that stuff doesn't matter to me anymore. I don't understand that physical peace. But if it was just that, if it was just that physical nature of alcoholism, Billy Brown would come to me and say, Cliff, you got an allergy, you just got to quit. And if you got an allergy, what do? You just stop, and what happens? Everything gets okay. But it's the third piece of alcoholism. It's that third piece, that mental obsession piece. It's that part of me that makes me a professional quitter. And I know I'm in a room of professional quitters here tonight. I mean, we've quit 1,000 times. The trouble is, I can't stop starting. I mean, I can tell you I'll quit. I mean, I'm a guy that I'll come home and my wife will say on a Thursday night, say something like, listen, I'm cooking dinner. It'll be ready in an hour. We need a loaf of bread. Can you go get that? And I'll say, absolutely. And off I'm running to the store to get some bread. I go in, I get some bread. And I got the bread and I come out with it. And I come out with the bread and I run to my buddy Randy up here. And Randy says, what are you doing? And I say, well, Lori's cooking dinner. It's going to be ready in 10 minutes. We needed bread. I went and got it. So now I'm going home. I got 50 minutes. I'm going home. And Randy looks at me and he says something like, it's 50 minutes. 50 minutes. Well, hey, man, we could go over to the old log in, have a couple of beers. You'll be home in 50 minutes. Well, when I get that kind of information, I filter that through the keen alcoholic mind. And I know you all know about the keen alcoholic mind because hell, AA is the only place we talk about that. I can assure you in the Al-Anon rooms, nobody ever mentions the keen alcoholic mind over there ever. But I filter that through the keen alcoholic mind and I think 50 minutes, two beers, I can do that. So on a Thursday night, my buddy Randy and I, we go to the log in to have a couple of beers. Now, Sunday, when I get home, everybody's mad at me. She's mad. The kids are mad. The dog mad. Cat mad. I don't know why. I got the bread. And I don't know if you've ever been in any kind of jackpot like that. But when I get in jackpots like that, I like to get everybody together because I got to tell them the story. And don't be mistaken. Everything alcoholics do in or out of the rooms involves a story. I mean, we are storytellers. We make up stuff. It's just that much more exciting that way. Somebody will go to the bathroom night, come out and say, you're not going to believe this, and just tell us a whole story about their adventure in the bathroom. But I start telling the story, and I talk about home, hour, dinner, store, bread, 50 minutes on the clock, Randy. And when I get to that part about Randy, something happens up here. It's like the inter-dialogue of my life. And it says something like this. There it is. There's the problem. Randy's the problem. If you hadn't run into Randy, you'd have been home. And I begin to tell the rest of the story from perspective that Randy's the problem. And when I get done telling the story, no matter what the facial expressions of the people that I'm telling it to, when I get done telling the story, it seems like I've said this 1,000 times. But I'll guarantee you one thing. I'll promise you one thing. I swear to God one thing. It'll never happen again. And you know what? If you'd have put a lie detector on me at that moment, I'll pass it. Because in that moment, I believe that. Because you know what? I'm looking into the eyes of the people that really I love the most. Looking at my mom, my dad, my brothers, my friends, any one of the four wives, children, employers, fellow employees, and I mean it. I'll pass a test. And so that night, it's still a little chilly at my house, but on Monday, I get up and I go to work. Now, on my way to work, I start to think about how they don't treat me right down there at work. I mean, I'm down there busting my hump 2-3 hours a day. I mean, I'm killing it at work. I mean, I got to go through traffic. I'm thinking I get down to work and, you know, they don't respect me down there the way they should. About 1 o'clock, I go back home. I start heading home and back through traffic again. And on the way home, this thought comes to me, whether it's on Monday or Tuesday, this thought comes to me. I don't know why they're still mad at me. I apologize Sunday. And when I get to that spot, I got one, two, really good streak, maybe 24 hours. And I'm going to find myself in a bar drinking, either intensely or not remember how I got there at somebody's house. And that's the piece of alcoholism that makes the people around us look at us and say, why would you do that again? And I love what our book says, and to talk about when we give a response to that, we usually don't know why. Because on any given time when I would drink, I couldn't come up with a reason why I would do that again in light of the consequences that surely followed. And it's those three pieces of alcoholism, the spiritual, the physical, and the mental, that I have no clue about that I have. I have no idea that's what God has me. They sent me to treatment in the 80s. I didn't think I had an alcohol problem. I was 27 years old. My God, who can be an alcoholic at 27, for Christ's sake? I mean, I was an alcoholic, but I don't want you good people to think that I didn't recognize I had some kind of problem. It seemed to me that my problem was I had a back problem. Everybody was on mine. I need to get them off. So I went to treatment. So I went and did treatment. I came back and they said, you got to go to AA. They didn't say I had to get a sponsor. They didn't say you have to read the book. They said you have to go to AA. And I'm a literalist. So I went to AA. I got there just before the meeting started. I left just as soon as it was over. And I'm living restless, irritable, discontent. And guess what? I start drinking. And I'm a guy that the book describes. I build up this future for my family. When I was 31 years old, I became the first named partner in a major, kind of a medium-sized firm in downtown Oklahoma City. We had a whole floor, one of those big office buildings like they have here. I mean, and I remember the night we had our open house and all these people came. And I'm thinking, this will be it. I mean, this will be it. I'm 31. I'm on top of the world. This will be it. And I remember that night when everybody left. And the thought came to me, is this it? Is this it? Because what I've discovered here is that as long as I'm trying to change the picture out here, it continues to leave me empty in here. And as I continue to stay empty in here, what it feels like is this big separation from me. I used to talk about and think and believe, and I think I said it because it just sounded so cute, that I have this big hole inside of me. And people say, well, it's that God-sized hole. But I don't think that's what it was anymore. I think that's what it looks like. I think what it was is those 41 years of my drinking and my selfishness and my behaviors. What happened is I just continued to pile up those resentments, those fears, bad sex conducts, harms to others. And the mountain got so high, the pile got so high, it threw such a big shadow, it looks like a hole. The shadow is so big because I've filled it with all these things. That it's not a hole. It's a shadow. It's the shadow of my life that I just drag around with me. In the summer of 2001, I got kicked out of my house again, which was no big deal, but she seemed somewhat serious this time. I'd had lots of wives kick me out. I've had wives to say that I'm leaving. I've had wives to file divorce papers. My second wife filed a divorce on our first year anniversary. That's not a good day. You know it's over. There's no hope in that one. But she seemed to be serious about this. And I had to come up with a plan. You guys ever had to come up with a plan, like in your drinking? So I devised a plan because she seemed pretty serious about this. And it was my house, but on that day, she convinced me it was more her house than mine. So I left when she kicked me out. And I came up with a newcomer plan. Now, if you're new or you're nearly new here tonight, listen up, because this is good. This may be the best pearl you get tonight. So I came up with a newcomer plan, which I think is important if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think everybody here needs to have a newcomer plan if you're new. This is my newcomer plan, that I'm going to go to AA for about 60 days. Till she settles down, because she's way out of bounds. Mm-hmm. And then when she settles down, I'm going to go back and live my life the way I want to live it. It's a good plan. It's a foolproof plan, unless you're alcoholic. And if you're alcoholic, it's not worth a dang. But I didn't know that. And so what I did was I did back in the 80s was that I went to AA, and I just came here and sat. And in the summer of 2001, it was June 30th when she kicked me out of the house. And on day 45, I got up out of a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and went right to a bar and started drinking. Because what I discovered in those 45 days for me is that, remember my friends I told you about that I used to drink with, and they found him, her, whatever? I'm not like them. I'm not like those people. When I stop drinking, my life doesn't get better. It gets progressively worse. Not objectively, not because suddenly I start losing things. But internally, what happened for me is in those 45 days is that 41 years of living hard every morning would show up at my house. Every day, internally, the restless, irritable, and discontentedness of 41 years showed up. The four horsemen were at my bed every morning and seemed to just follow me all day long. And I don't know how your alcoholism looks on you, but I can tell you how it looks on me. Alcoholism never visits me when I'm not drinking at 3 in the afternoon. It's always 3 in the morning. Cliff, get up. We've been up for a couple hours. We need to get you in the game. Get in here. We got a lot of stuff to cover with you. And they just start going. And they start telling me all the things of my life. And on day 45, I got up out of an AA meeting, went right to a bar, started drinking. It was on a Thursday. Guess when I came home? Sunday. Nobody's happy to see me. There was some more discussion about whose house it was. Again, more hers than mine. Mm-hmm. And she threw me out again. I went and detoxed on the guy's couch. And on August the 15th of 2001, I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sat down here. And I need to tell you, I didn't know it was going to be the day I sat down in AA. I mean, I think really, if you've got a sobriety date, it would be just as well for any of us to take in a dart and thrown it at a calendar. I had no idea August 15th is going to be my day. Didn't plan that. Matter of fact, I had a revised newcomer plan that day. The revised newcomer plan was 60 to 90 days to get back in the house. Got to figure out how to get over the 45-day hump. But I'm going to figure it out. Because at any given moment, as you are, I'm the smartest person in the room at any given moment. And I'm going to figure it out. That I'm going to figure out how to do that. Because all my life, it seemed to me that I had figured out how to do things. And if I just get a little bit of time, if I could just get it gathered up, I'll figure out how to do this. And I need to tell you, that last 3 years before the summer of 2001, I never drew a sober breath, nor did I turn a tap to work. But this time, my wife, Lori, who some of you all know, my wife, Lori, had this phenomenal job. She was selling sports radio when sports radio first came on the scene. And she was doing well. So I became what I like to call a functioning alcoholic. Hell, I had a wife that worked. So that was good, right? But I became a real go-getter. I'd take her to work and go get her. That's what I would do. So, but I'm sitting at that AA meeting on August 15th, 2001. No thoughts about getting sober. My thoughts are, how do I drink? How do I stay sober? I've been thinking that since she kicked me out. How do I drink? How do I stay sober? I'm going to figure the laws of physics out and beat them. And there was 5 minutes left in that AA meeting, and my head went stone cold quiet. Now, if you've got a head that likes to talk to you and it goes quiet, that's an attention getter. I scooted right to the edge of my seat. And the next thought that came to me was this. If you don't do something different today, you're going to die. And what I know today is that that's a voice that did not originate in me, because that's not my thoughts. My thoughts are, how do I drink? And how do I stay sober? Well, that day the thought was, if you don't do something different, you're going to die. And you good people ended your meeting. I got up and stood in your circle. I held your hands. You said the Lord's Prayer. And I just did what I've always been doing. I broke for the door. Now, what I didn't tell you, those 45 days I've been going to Alcoholics Anonymous, there'd been an old man there. It started on June 30th, and every day thereafter, that old man would catch me after the meetings. And he would look at me and he'd say, Bub, how are you doing? And I would give him the alcoholic answer. Fine, I'm fine. And he would just look at me and he'd say, well, listen, if there's ever anything I can do for you, let me know. And I would think, man, if there is, or there's nothing you can do for me. And I'd say, okay, and I'm just blaze a trail. And on August 15th, 2001, I got up, I busted out of that meeting, and that old man caught me one more time. And he looked at me and he said, I hope he's all right. He just looked at me and said, Bub, how are you doing? And on that day, I gave him a different answer. I just looked at him and said, man, Don, I'm not doing good at all. And he looked at me. Man, it was all dead serious. He goes, I know. I know. Let me tell you about Don. Don's one of those guys that he had this fundamental belief about Alcoholics Anonymous. He believed If you weren't at the meeting 30 minutes before the meeting started, you were late. You were late. And I don't know about you all when you first got here to Alcoholics Anonymous, but there's no place worse than being somewhere you don't want to be than being there 30 minutes early. And so, I mean, he just had this belief. And he would get there and he would do what I observed happen here tonight. The coffee, he would make the coffee, he'd set the rooms up, he'd have everything out. Or he would have what I would describe at the time as acolytes, and they would be over out in the kind of the ante room. They only know three things: read, write, pray. That's all they know. Read, write, pray. That's all they know. And then they would float into the room, and the meeting would start. And I don't know how they do it here. I'm sure it's wrong, but in Oklahoma, they always do this deal after they open the meeting and kind of go around. And say, "Is there any AA related announcements?" And it seemed to me that every day Don would drone on and on and on about everything going on in AA worldwide. I mean, sometimes it was like 45 seconds. It was forever. It was forever. And if there was a newcomer at the meeting, Don and the acolytes would be on them like chicken on a June bug. I mean, just attack mode. I mean, they'd be giving books, writing numbers, and old Don would hang back. And he would certainly give his number, but Don would do something different than the acolytes. He'd get a number. Because what Don knew that the acolytes didn't know was that any real alcoholic, new to Alcoholics Anonymous, can never pick up the 10,000 pound bottle. So he'd get your number, he'd call you, see how you were doing. I don't know about your sponsorship, I don't know about your life, but I hope that you have somebody like Don in your life. I hope you do. You know, that day when he caught me, he said, "I know." He looked at me and said, "Well, Cliff, listen, if there's ever anything I can do for you, let me know." And of course, my head said what it always said. There's nothing you can do for me. Because I believe there was nothing anybody could do for me. Because see, what was happening was, oh, Don kept offering me a solution that I was not interested in. I mean, my whole life, it seems to me, I've walked around and people have tried to help me. But I'm like a guy that's in the ocean drowning. I mean, I'm about Bob 2.5. I mean, my nose is barely sticking out, and a Coast Guard cutter comes by, pulls up, whips out, and throws me a blue life preserver. And I grab it, and I look at it, and I throw it back and say, "I only accept orange. Only orange life preservers." But that's my life. People try to offer me a solution that I really don't want. And so I just give it back, and I'm dying. And the struggle with a guy like me is I don't really know how bad I am. I've lived this alcoholic life so long, as our book describes, it has become the only normal life. I mean, when I graduated law school, I graduated 7th in my class. And I'm not telling you that to brag about that. I'm talking about what alcoholism and alcohol are the great takers. They take everything. You'll have people come behind this podium. I've known you heard speakers talk about how they've lost this and they've lost that. You need to hear this from me and hear it really clear. I've never lost anything. I gave it away. I gave it away to live the kind of life my mind tells me that I have to live. Just gave it away. And I looked at Don, and everything in my head screamed, "There's nothing you can do for me." But out of my mouth came this: "I need a sponsor." And talk about getting excited. I mean, he started gyrating around. I thought he was going to pee his pants, quite frankly. He said, "Let's sit down." I said, "That's a good idea, I think, right?" And what Don did, he sat down and he began to describe what he was like, what had happened, and what he was like today in a language for the first time in my life I was able to hear. You know, our book talks about that some of us had to be beaten into a state of reasonableness. I love the next line. It says, for some of us, this was a tedious process. You know, I had to take a lot of butt whippings to get here because you're offering me a solution that I don't want. And I'm going to tell you the strangest thing. I've tried everything prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, changing wives, changing jobs, changing locations, trying to get everything out here to look right. Alcoholics Anonymous is the very last thing I tried. And the very first thing that worked in my life. I believed all my life that I could stop drinking. I was looking at my friends and how they drank, and they drank like me at some point in our life. And I thought, I can quit whenever I want to. And I'm going to tell you, on that day with Don, when he and I talked that day, the thought came to me, I may not can stop. And since I've had that thought, I've never had another drink again. My whole life, I believed I could stop any time, and I never was able to. And the minute I thought, I may not be able to stop, I've never had another drink since then. And so, you know, Don talked to me about alcoholism, what he was like, what had happened to him, and I just pushed all my chips to the middle of the table. And I just went all in on Alcoholics Anonymous. And what Don did was he got me in the book and he got me in the steps. And he was a guy that believed in the book. He believed in the power of the steps. He believed that those steps were a runway to God. And he believed that he put me on that runway because his experience was when his sponsor put him on that runway and he took the actions outlined in that book and he did the things that was asked of him out of that book. He got connected to a power that he came to believe in and described as God. Now, if you're here tonight and you're one of those people that when you hear the word God, it gives you the heebie-jeebies. Whatever you believe in, whatever it is you think of, that's what I'm talking about tonight. I'm just using God because it's a shortcut because I get tired of saying power greater than yourself every day. It takes up too much of my time. It's not that I have a lot to say. It just takes me a long time to say it. So I shortcut it to say God. But he put me on a track of that because what he knew about me that I did not know about myself was this idea that I lacked power, this powerlessness and unmanageability. And I had it all confused. I thought, if I just gather it up and get enough steam, I'll be able to do whatever I want to do. You know, this relationship or non-relationship I had with God that, look, God, you just do whatever it is you do, and I'll do whatever I do, and never the twain may meet. And I'm going to tell you, I lived up to my part of that deal with God. The trouble was he didn't live up to his part. And that he always maintained a presence in my life, uninvited. And the moment that I conceded that, my gosh, this is me, Don looked at me and he said, do you hope what's working for me can work for you? And man, I'm so desperate. Finally, I agreed to accept the blue life preserver. And he said, we're going to take the third step. And in that moment, in the time we were together right there, he talked to me about alcoholism. He asked me about hope, and he got me on my knees, and we started praying the third step prayer. And I want to tell you what old Don would do is every Monday night, I would go to his house, and I would read the book. And he would give me reading assignments. I want you to read this. Then on Monday, he would say, did you read? And I'd say, yes. And he said, we're going to read it again, like he didn't trust me. And so we'd read it again. And what Don would do was he would explain the book to me. And I don't know if you recall when you're new or if you're new here, but when I started reading that book, it seemed to me that the textbook was written in Russian. And unfortunately, I just understand Chinese. And so I'm reading that book. It makes no sense to me. And Don would explain it, and he would ask me questions. He would give me historical perspective on the book. But I think the most important thing he would do is he began to ask me questions. Did your drinking ever begin to disturb other people like Bill's began to disturb Lois? Did you ever have that sensation that you had arrived? Let's talk about those times in your life where you felt like you had arrived. And there were many points in my life where I thought, this is it. This is it. And the crazy part, it never was it. It was so fleeting. And he would break down step 2, 3. I did an inventory. I shared it with somebody. We talked about 6 and 7. I made a list. I started making amends. And I want to tell you something, in a little bit of time I got left here, I don't want you to leave here not thinking that guy got sober and his trajectory's been just rocketed to the moon. I'm going to tell you, since I got sober, my trajectory has mostly been up. But I'm a guy that's had some troubles in AA. I mean, there was a point in my sobriety where for lack of a better description, where I just got over sober here. I just got really godly in Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsorship and how I approached the book was very didactic. I mean, I was a big disunifier in AA. If you didn't do it this way, your group was doing it wrong. And I'm a guy that would talk bad about your group. I would run other members down. I'd gossip behind your back. I mean, I'm a total violator of every tradition on that wall. And it got so bad that one day I came home and I have no clue that I'm this way. I think I'm doing good, very evangelistic. And one day I came home and my wife said, I need to talk to you. And she sat me down. She goes, I don't know you. You're physically sober, but you're not spiritually sober, not emotionally sober, and you got to go. And at 9 years sober, a real somebody in AA. I just finished chairing our area conference. I was just rotating in as our area chair in Oklahoma. I mean, I'm making a name for myself in an anonymous program. So, which in and of itself ought to tell you how sick I was. And at 9 years sober, I got thrown out of my house again. Not because I drank, because I spiritually got off track. You know, the greatest promise in our steps, I believe, is the 12th step, where it talks about having had a spiritual awakening on the runway. If I do these actions, I get a lift off in 12, this awakening. And my gosh, my experience here is that if you're desperate enough, if you've come here with the willingness to accept the blue life preserver, you know, a monkey with cue cards in that book could keep you sober. Do this, do this, do this. And you'll have an awakening. I've watched people, I've sponsored people who said, I don't believe in God, this will never work. And they're sober 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years. The real key in the Alcoholics Anonymous, it's not having the awakening. Sure, that's a big deal. But staying awake here. Because I guarantee you, the people in this room, whether you've been here a year or 50 years, have watched people come to this room in rooms like this, get sober, have that reaction, go back to sleep and walk right out our door. Just right out. And 10, 11, 12 are where I stay awake in Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of people, I can't live on 1 through 9. And I can't just do lip service to 10, 11, 12. What I have to do is what the book talks about in 10, continuously. I don't want you to think I'm perfect. I fall way short, but continuously means moment by moment. Because what 10, 11, and 12 do for me, 12 talks about practicing these principles in all my affairs. That means every moment of my life, I'm looking at 10 and saying, how am I doing? I'm in fear. I'm in selfishness. Am I resentful? Staying in the moment. 10, 11, and 12 help me to do the things that's been the most difficult thing, I think, for me and maybe most alcoholics. Staying in the right here, right now. Because in the right here, right now, is the only place that God exists. And in the right here, right now, is the only place God exists for us so that we can have each other. I want to thank Jerry, and I want to thank all of you all for having me tonight. Thank you very much.